Well, welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. We're glad you're here. As you know, our program today is about the lost world of Genesis 1, ancient cosmology, and the origins debate. And we're fortunate to have Dr. John Walton with us, who has recently published a book by that title. He's a professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College, and we are very glad to have you with us today. As we begin our time together, I ask Roy Gain if he would offer a word of prayer.
Father in heaven, our Creator, to you we give all the glory. We believe that you made us. We don't understand all of the processes by which you did that because you're so much greater than we are. You have dimensions that we don't comprehend. In our finite wisdom, we're trying to see pieces of a much bigger puzzle and put them together. We have the inspired record, and we have the background of the ancient Near East, and there's the natural world that we can see, we can measure, we can examine. You know, Lord, the issues of faith at stake here. And we pray that as we have this stimulating discussion with a challenging new perspective presented, that you would be with our presenter and be with us as we process this and as we discuss. May we learn new things. And whichever way we go on certain of the details, may all of this dialectic and the back and forth that we're going to enter here be productive and positive in building our faith. So we thank you for your goodness and for your spirit and for your word to guide us. We don't want to rewrite your word, we just want to understand it. And we want to understand the parts that are important for us to understand rather than twisting things or trying to get it to answer questions that it was never designed to answer. So we're grateful for this occasion and for your Sabbath, which is the pinnacle, the birthday of the world, the culmination of the creation week. And we thank you that we have this wonderful day, that we can put aside other things, that we can rest as you rested and celebrate what you did, because our very breath is in your hands. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, we have a pretty full house today. Unfortunately, one of our regular forum members, attendees, is not here. As some of you may know, Walter Booth passed away at the end of last month, died in his sleep at home. He was a very faithful part of our group, had thoughtful comments, and always made in a respectful, gentlemanly fashion, and we appreciate it, and we miss him. There is a memorial service being held today at the Eau Claire Seventh-day Adventist Church at 5 o'clock in his memory. On a happier note, I would just like to thank those of you who have supported the forum financially with your contributions during the past year. We are grateful, and we're excited about the possibility of being able to move out into a little wider circle of speakers and so on that would have been beyond our reach without your support. So we do thank you for that. Our next forum meeting is on February 26. Dr. Charles Scriven, the president of Kettering College of Medical Arts in Ohio, is going to be with us discussing his recently published book, The Promise of Peace, subtitled Toward a Post-Conventional Adventism. Sounds like an appropriate forum topic, doesn't it? As many of you are aware, he also serves as chairman of the board for the National Association of Adventist Forums organization. Then in March, Rebecca Liu, who is a ordained Seventh-day Adventist minister in China, will be with us discussing issues related to women and ministry and the Adventist Church, particularly in China. And then on April 9, we have Michael Schofield, who is a consultant from Loma Linda, California. He'll be here to discuss Adventist higher education in North America. Which school shall we close first? So any of you who are worried about don't have tenure or whatever, well, you may want to be here to hear that. A few little housekeeping things. Any students here that want to log their presence for the EIGN program, there's a sign-up sheet in the back that you can do that. If some of you aren't getting email announcements of our programs and would like to, again, there's sign-up sheets in the back where you can give us your name and email address so that we can keep you informed. And we continue to appreciate the behind-the-scenes work of Marilyn, our treasurer, of Jim Harris, who helps us with all the technology that seems to baffle the rest of us, Debbie and Terry, who help with publicity. So we do appreciate those things, even though they don't show up on our afternoon meetings particularly. Well, our program today, as I mentioned, is about the lost world of Genesis 1, ancient cosmology, and the origins debate. Dr. Walton is an Old Testament scholar, professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College. He's been on the faculty there since 2001. Before joining the Wheaton faculty, he taught for about 20 years at the Moody Bible Institute. His PhD is in Hebrew and Cognate Studies from Hebrew Union College. He has been active editor and author. He's the general editor of the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary for the Old Testament. Other books that he has done include Jonah for the Expositor's Bible Commentary, Ancient Near Eastern Thought in the Old Testament, and the Essential Bible Companion. Dr. Francis Collins, who I'm sure all of you scientists are recognized, and probably most of the non-scientists, he was head of the Human Genome Project and is now actually the director of the National Institutes of Health, and an openly Christian scientist. He has talked about Dr. Walton's book that he'll be discussing today. He says it presents a profoundly important new analysis of the meaning of Genesis. It elevates Scripture to a new level of respectful understanding. And then he says that it eliminates any conflict between science and scriptural descriptions of origins. Well, that's a pretty tall order to live up to. But you can see that this book is a pretty thoughtful book that's been respected by other thoughtful people. I learned this week that here in our local community, the Andrews University Seminary study is planning a whole issue devoted to the thinking about the issues that Dr. Walton is raising from an Adventist perspective. And so we'll look forward to seeing that coming out. And I believe it's the spring issue, but I'm not positive on that. Some of us here have read Dr. Walton's book. I suspect that after you hear the presentation today, some of you who haven't read it will probably want to. Those of you who heard the presentation last night already know that Dr. Walton does a very good idea, a good job of explaining his ideas, and is thoughtful and insightful, and we're in for a treat. So we're very pleased that you've come to share with us. We thank you for it, and the time is yours.
Thank you. It's really a great pleasure for me to be here and to be able to speak to you. I enjoyed last evening, and we've had a couple opportunities today to speak to various groups, and it's just been a very pleasant visit to the campus, and so I'm grateful to be able to be here to talk about things that are extremely important to me, and I suspect, since you're here, extremely important to you. I don't come before you with some kind of profession of having, arrived at ultimate truth. I come to you with some ideas that I've had the privilege of encountering and developing because of my particular expertise and training, and there are things that I think can be helpful for people to consider. That's been confirmed as my book has been out now for a year and a half or so, and I received many emails, which is really unusual. I've written a number of books and never get emails, but it's but this one I get emails, and it's very encouraging that a high percentage of them are very positive and saying, this really helped me. And if you find that as I present my information that it really helps you, I'm very glad for that. If you find that it's something that you kind of feel like you need to keep at arm's length, that's good too. It's just giving you some things to think about. Some of you, maybe it'll make you angry. That may not be such a bad thing either. Every time we think through these issues, we have a chance to spot something that's going to help us. And so I hope this will be a mutually encouraging time as I present the ideas that I've got to lay before you. When I come to difficult issues in the Bible, this is very significant. I want to be able to think outside the box. For me, thinking outside the box doesn't mean challenging the bedrock theology that I need to believe. That's not up for a question. But we have loads of interpretation things along the way. And some of them we need to haul out again, put them on the table, look at them real carefully, and find out whether we're missing something, whether there's something that we should be taking into consideration that we've overlooked. And so it's that kind of exercise that I want to be willing to think outside the box. I don't want to just tell everyone else they have to think outside the box. I want to be able to think outside the box. And in my mind, if I'm not open to reconsidering how I have interpreted Scripture, it might mean that I'm not really submitting myself to its authority the way that I need to. Because I need to know what God's Word is saying, and sometimes I can get in the way. Sometimes our traditional modes of thinking can get in the way. Sometimes our own agendas can get in the way. And I don't want anything to get in the way of God's Word coming through. And it's in that spirit that I present these things, so that we might have opportunity to think through some ideas that might end up being helpful. Being willing to think outside the box, not to reconstruct God's Word into something we want it to be, but to understand as best we can what it is in the stewardship that we have as He's given His Word to us. Now, I've got a lot of training and experience in ancient Near Eastern literature. And what I'm going to present today suggests a lot of connection between some aspects of the biblical text and ancient Near Eastern ways of thinking. But I wouldn't want anybody to believe, or to conclude, I should say, that I've come to this material by reading ancient Near Eastern literature, taking what I find there, and then kind of pushing it into the Bible. That's not how it happened. As I developed the ideas that I'm going to present, I saw them in the Bible first. There were lots of different areas where I used to say, well, here's an area where the ancient Near East and the Bible are very different. And I was comfortable with that. And lots of people were comfortable with that. But I got to a point where I started to see some things in the biblical text that suggested to me otherwise. And so I developed these ideas in the biblical text and then found that some of the same kinds of things were already there in the ancient Near East. I also want to make it clear, as I did last night, but since some of you may not have been there, that when we talk about using the ancient Near Eastern literature, it's not like we're giving that any kind of authority, or that we're putting it alongside the Bible as being somehow just as valid. Some of the literature of the ancient world is disgusting. Some of the mythology, it's so sexually oriented. This is nothing like our Bible at all. Okay, but when we read ancient literature, we get an opportunity to get a little window into the ancient world because we don't think like they thought. And I want those windows so I can understand the ancient world. I don't look at the Bible through the ancient Near East. I look at the ancient world through the ancient Near Eastern literature. Then with what I learn from the ancient Near Eastern world, I try to say, is there anything like that that I see operating in the biblical text? Because the way the ancient Near Eastern world thought may be a lot different than what I do. So when I read ancient Near Eastern literature, I can see how important the corporate identity is, for instance. And I can understand corporate identity, and that feeds into things like arranged marriages and things like that, all kinds of things in their culture. And I can take that understanding of culture, then say, okay, what do I find in the Bible? Well, I find that same sort of corporate identity. I find arranged marriages. I find all of the different perspectives of clan and family and land that are reflected through ancient Near Eastern literature. And that all helps me because I am not a corporate identity person. None of us really are. We're Americans and we're individualists. And so we have to learn to see that world that was part of the Old Testament, the Israelites' way of thinking, lest we somehow bring our very different viewpoints into the text. In that sense, the knowledge that I gain of the ancient world through its literature becomes a censor, a restraining thing to keep me from reading my cultural ways of thinking into the text. I hope that helps you a little bit. That's just a very brief introduction to how we come at the material. So I want to start in the biblical text with our passage in Genesis 1. So the first question that I would... Oops, don't want to do that. No. First question I would ask... Why didn't God call the light light? This is where it started for me. Day one. There you're reading it. God said, let there be light. And God separated the light from the darkness. And the light he called day, and the darkness he called night. Why didn't he just call the light light? Is light light or isn't it? Why call it day? Then it's not light, it's day. What's going on here? You've read the passage 100 times. Maybe you never thought to ask the question. I know that was my situation. And then I asked it, and suddenly things started jumping all around. Why didn't God call the light light? Well, he called it day. And so we have to ask the relationship of day to light. This all seems pretty simple, but stay with me, okay? First of all, light in the ancient world is not an object. We might have discussions among our physicists of when it's like a particle and when it's like a wave, and we can treat it as a material thing. But that's our physics. That's not ancient world. And they wouldn't have thought of the light as an object. Likewise, they wouldn't have thought of the darkness as an object. We don't either. So they're not thinking of something material happening there when God says, let there be light. But again, it's not really light that's the focus. Because he calls it day. Now, of course, it's very simple. Day is a period of light. In language things, that's called metonymy, the connection between them like that. And so God, it was the period of light that he called day, and the period of darkness that he called night. You can see this is all pretty simple stuff. Okay, so God called the period of light day and the period of darkness he called night, evening and morning, day one. Sounds good. Okay, now we track back. That was verse 5. We track back into verse 4. We say, okay, God separated the light from the darkness. Well, they can't be separated because they can't be together because darkness is the absence of light. And so what are we talking about here? Well, same solution helps us out. God separated the period of light from the period of darkness. And that period of light he called day, and the period of darkness he called night. Okay, that's working well. Okay, now it makes sense that he separated them. He gave them each their slots to work in, and then he named the slots day and night. We're good. Everything going fine. You with me? But then we back up into verse 3. God said, let there be. Be careful. If it was period of light in verse 5, and it was period of light in verse 4, consistency suggests that we ought to say, God said, let there be a period of light. And so God separated between a period of light and a period of darkness, and the period of light he named day. Was that mine? And the period of darkness he named night. Could have sworn I turned that off. Let's all take a moment and turn off our cell phones. I was very, very late in time getting a cell phone. I waited way beyond what normal people would have waited and finally got one. And the very first time I ever got a call on the cell phone, I was actually giving a lecture. And I said, stop, this is the first one I've ever gotten. I've got to answer it. Okay, anyway, back to the phone. Okay, so God created the period of light. God said, let there be a period of light. Okay, so we ask a question then. This leads us to a really very much more important question than this one. What is happening on day one? What is God doing? And as this all happened, by the way, when I started thinking all of these things, it was in the middle of a lecture. I mean, I was doing a course on Genesis, and we were talking through it, and I went through this sequence, and suddenly all kinds of jumbled thoughts starting coming together, and we ended up ditching the lecture and trying to work the problem. But when you ask the question, well, then what is it that God created on day one? Well, if it's a period of light, period of darkness, day and night, he created day and night. He created time. There's nothing material on day one. Light, again, they wouldn't have viewed it as anything material. So to them, remember, we're thinking Israelite audience, those of you who were here last night, this is not material in their minds. And the text doesn't present it that way. It presents it as a period of time, and it is time. Now, time is not a thing. Time is a function. And so that got me thinking about this idea of functions and the importance of them. After all, if God is naming things, he is assigning them functions through their names. That's how they thought in the ancient world. If God is separating things, he is separating them into their functional categories. And it got me thinking that maybe we have underestimated the importance of functions. Now, we certainly value functions in our world. And we understand that structures or material, physicality, those kinds of things lead to functions. And we're very interested in the way that the world works. Sometimes that's our reasons for doing science, so we can understand how the world works, how it functions. Of course, in the ancient world, it was much stronger than that. They're interested in who's in charge. Now, there are lots of those areas where we're interested in who's in charge, too. When you get a new job, okay, you don't just right away start asking about, oh, who built this building? And when did the Articles of Incorporation take place? No, you say, who do I answer to? Who tells me what to do? Right? Who am I responsible to? Who signs my checks? Okay? Corporate chart is more important than the corporate history. We're interested in functions. So the idea then of what is the focus of Genesis 1? Obviously, there's no doubt that Genesis 1 is an origins account. But origins of what? Origins of everything? Well, it's not origins of angels. It doesn't talk about that. Origins of what? And what part of the story are they telling? See, there's no doubt in my mind that whatever has been made, God made it. Okay, and whether that's planets or stars or nebulae, you know, they happen. Anyway, not a scientist. Whatever is, God did it. But nobody can tell all of that story. You're going to choose parts of the story to tell. Which part of the story is Genesis 1 telling? And so that's what I set out to explore. We think of light and darkness in different categories, as the cartoon indicates to us. But again, in the ancient world, they were pretty much in the same category. The conclusion that I draw on day one is that on day one, God created the basis for time, this alternating periods of day and night, in his first step to bring order to the cosmos. In Israelite and in ancient Near Eastern thinking, order is sort of the key theme in wisdom. Wisdom allows you to see order, whether it's order in the cosmos or order in your politics of the nation or order in your family or order in your marriage or order with your kids or order in your ethical behavior. Wisdom asks you to see that order, to understand it, and to structure your life by it. And that's why we find creation is a common theme in wisdom literature. So order is very important in the ancient world. And the idea that God has brought order to the world is much more significant to them than that God has brought materiality. People are going to address an issue based on the values that they have. If their values are mostly connected to functions and order, then that's the part of the story they're going to want to tell. The fact that we may have much higher levels of interest in material is our problem, not theirs. We have to let the text do what it does and what it's doing. And if they have more interest in functions, it doesn't matter that we have more interest in material. Now, I've thereby introduced a distinction, and we need to talk about it some. When we understand the idea of create, what comes into our mind? Well, for the most part, for our minds, because we think highly of material aspects of our world, we think of creation in material terms. To create, then, would mean that you brought material into existence. Now, again, remember, this isn't a question of what God did or didn't do. Everything that is, God did. But which part of the story is the Bible telling? Now, if you're going to talk about creation and what that means, you have to back up a little to another philosophical issue, to what it means to exist. Is existence defined materially? Now, again, for us, it typically is. We think of existence in material terms. And in fact, we are so convinced of the material aspects of existence that we probably don't even imagine somebody could think any differently than that. What could existence possibly mean if it's not connected to materiality? The fact is, in the ancient world, they did think a different way. They thought of existence in different terms. If you think of existence in different terms, then creation is going to mean something different. Because creation means to bring something into existence. We think of existence in material terms. So create means to bring things into material existence. If you thought of existence in different terms, then create would take on a different meaning. Now, we all know this about the word create, because even in English, we find variations. We talk about people creating a masterpiece, creating a committee, creating a curriculum, creating havoc. All non-material in nature, although materials are involved. Those of you who are on a committee, you believe there is a material involved. You are materially existing. But a committee is not a material thing. So we even use the word create in various kinds of contexts. So what kind of creation is the biblical text talking about? And how do they think about existence? One of the ways to address that, of course, is to look at the language. Okay, it doesn't do us any good, really, in the end, to just look at the English word create, because we've got our ideas behind that. Let's look at the Hebrew verb bara. In the beginning, God barad, he created the cosmos. Well, what kind of act is involved there? Now, if it referred to a material act, that is, bringing something materially into existence, then we would expect that consistently the direct object of that verb, created what, would be something material, if the verb has to do with material objects. So our task then is to go in and look at the occurrences of bara to find out what kinds of direct objects it has, to see if they are consistently material. Got the logic? That's what we're trying to do. So we do our little study. We find that there are approximately 50 occurrences of the verb, and it only takes God as a subject or the actor. Lots of commentaries will tell you that. So this is a divine activity. But then here's the key. When we get to the objects, look at the kinds of things we have. People groups, Jerusalem, phenomena, wind, fire, cloud, calamity, darkness, abstractions, purity. Create in me a pure heart, O God. Psalm 51. There's bara. Not material. Psalmist isn't saying, take out that blood pump that I've got. Give me a better one. This is not a heart transplant. There's something functional going on here. Okay? Even when it's talking about objects where there's material involved. People. God created people. You say, see, material. Male and female, he created them. Oops, functional. We find then that bara often involves direct objects that are not material at all, but that have to do with functions. Something working, being ordered, being brought into existence in that way. So we're finding then that our thinking is being stretched about how people thought about existence and therefore creation in the ancient world. Now, if Genesis 1 were intending to be an account of material origins, we would expect it to start with no material. If it's something else, then we would expect a different starting point. My own understanding of verse 1 in Genesis 1 is that it is a literary introduction. Now, it may be that some of you would disagree with that, and that's fine. I'm certainly not the only one that thinks this. It's rather a common view that we've got a literary introduction in verse 1. As a literary introduction, we'd be reading it something like, in the beginning, God created the cosmos. Now, let me tell you how he did that. Okay? Literary introduction to the chapter. So in that sense, the beginning of the story is verse 2. And there are supports, there's reasons to believe that verse 1 is that, but I'm not going to go through them now. I go through them in the book, and again, there are common explanations that are given. But it starts in verse 2 with the earth there. It's described, tohu vavohu, formless and empty, whatever. We'll talk about it. Okay? But notice in the middle of the verse, we have the waters. They're already there. In the ancient world, the cosmic waters were part of the non-functional cosmos. They had not been incorporated into the ordered sphere of human existence. And they were part of that which was non-functional. And so Genesis 1:2 does not paint a world without material. It paints a world without order, darkness, and water, which is common in the rest of the ancient Near East. They also started with darkness and water, and also focused on that which brought order, organization, and functionality. Now, again, I don't read the Bible that way because I see it in the ancient Near East. I saw it in the Bible first. And then the ancient Near East, I saw this is what it was like in the ancient world. So it's no surprise that the Bible's thinking in those terms. So I went looking around on the words here, tohu and vohu, and sure enough, in their usages, they largely concern functions, not material. So formless doesn't quite hit it, because that suggests without material form. No, it really has to do without function, without order. It's not productive. It's not working the way that it should. It's not quite the Greek idea of chaos, because with chaos there was something sort of evil about it and personified. It's not that. It's just not yet productive and functioning the way that it should. So the starting point is not lacking matter, but lacking order and function. Darkness and sea are elements of chaos in the ancient world. And tohu talks about lacking worth or purpose, a place where nothing is done. Egyptian parallel, there is a concept of the non-existent. And the non-existent are not things that are non-material, but that are non-functional. And so they have a reference to that which has not yet been differentiated. Separating is a creative act that gives functions, but has not yet been assigned to functions, yet having potentiality. For them, the desert was non-existent. The cosmic waters and the oceans, non-existent, because they weren't in the ordered cosmos. Now, this is not the way we think. And that makes it very difficult to wrap our minds around it. But there's ample evidence in the Bible and in the world around the Bible that that is how they think. That existence is defined functionally, not materially. And if existence is defined functionally, then to bring something into existence would be a functional act, bringing order and giving it its role in an ordered system. Again, this would not suggest that God had not done the material work. It's a question of what part of the story is Genesis 1 telling. Now, as we try to summarize what we might find in ancient Near Eastern cosmological texts, there's very little concerning material origins. So that's how they approach it. The pre-creation state is absent of function, same as I'm suggesting here. Creation involves giving functions, and the temple and cosmos, I'll get to that in a moment. Okay, so again, what we find in the Bible is tracking with what we see in the rest of the ancient world. Now, when we talk about Egyptian cosmology, we find these kinds of diagrams and paintings and their sarcophagi and their coffins, things of that sort, which show a picture of the way they thought about the cosmos. And they did not think about it in material terms. This is a reproduction from one of the sarcophagi. But I've got a modern representation of it as well, the same kind of picture. You can see that for them, the cosmos is populated by the gods, because they're not interested in what the material stuff might be. They're interested in the gods and their roles. Who's in charge? And so they've got this kind of picture. The Lady arched above the top is the sky. You can see all the stars emblazoned on her body. The air god, right here, has separated the earth from the sky. They were lovers, and so it's kind of a tough, you know, distance relationships. Okay? So he's separated them and holds them apart, you know? And so here's the earth god down here. And again, it's represented in that one as well. So the air god separating the earth from the heavens. We've got the sun bark sailing across the sky with the sun god and the moon god as the poleman in the back. We've got the storm god over here fighting Apophis. Every morning when the sun rose, Apophis tries to swallow it. Every day. Gets tiring, and Seth has to go defeat him every day. Okay, now, this is ancient mythology, and it's not attractive to our world of thinking or values at all. But do you see the point it gets across? When they think about the cosmos, they're not thinking about material stuff. They're thinking about functions, rule, who's in charge. That's their perspective. That's their values. That's much more important than the stuff. They did not think of this as a material representation at all. They didn't think that you could take a rock and hit this lady in the ankle. It's not material in the least, because they've chosen which values and which truths to highlight. We should expect that the Israelite text, the Bible, is going to do the same. Highlight the values that are most important. Now, this might be a little more how you'd present the Israelite way of thinking. You can see it's not peopled by gods, because they don't have that mythological, many gods kind of viewpoint. Okay, but it's still an old world kind of cosmology. It's the same diagram still. There's still the sky stretched above. Okay, all of these things come out of biblical text. And they had an old world cosmology. And that's okay. We talked about that whole thing last night and about, you know, the fact that God can use the way they thought in order to communicate the values that he wanted to communicate and the truth that he wanted to convey. No matter how you think the world looks, whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun, whether the earth is flat or it's round, no matter what you think about how the world looks and works, God's the one who set it up to work. It functions at his command, and it functions at his whim, if you would say it that way. God's the one who makes it work, and that's the most important thing. So the Israelite picture would be somewhat different, but it still wouldn't be how we draw it in modern scientific ways of thinking. But it's a world of functions. Now, of course, that view of things was retained even up into the time of the Reformation. In the ancient world, they believed there was a solid sky. They argued about what it was made out of. Some said stone, because they occasionally saw meteorites and found meteorites, and there's stone. You know, Truman Show, when the stage light fell from the, you know. That's what's up there. Others thought it was a tent or tent poles or that held it up. Some thought it was dangled from something. So they had arguments about that, but they all believed it was a solid sky. And through the rabbis and up into the church fathers, they're still talking about that solid sky. Now, eventually, of course, we all decided there wasn't a solid sky up there. And for a while, that was thought to jeopardize the authority of Scripture. But the church worked its way through it, and it didn't jeopardize the truth of Scripture. Okay, but the idea being then that God did communicate to them by means of some of the ideas, the way they already thought about things. But the truth that he was communicating was, again, I would say, functional in nature, not material in nature. He wasn't communicating what the material world looked like, nor was he even communicating how the material origins unfolded. Let me pause for a moment. When I'm trying to read the text this way, I am trying to read it as literally as I possibly can. You cannot read a text more literally than by reading it in terms of what the author intended and thought and wrote. That's what we're after. Okay, it's not literal reading or taking the text seriously if we are discarding the way they would think and replacing it with the way we think. The most literal reading we can have is the reading that respects what the author was intending to say. And as I mentioned last night, that means we have to penetrate their world. Now, this distinction between functional and material. Take a look at this. Dilbert's picking it up. Every project you worked on this year got canceled after reorganization. A functional negation. It's as if you didn't even exist. Functional ontology. Well, that's not entirely true. I occupied space. Material ontology. Right? He occupied space. That's material. His boss is arguing functional. I'd like to see someone who doesn't exist do that. Well, a dead person can occupy space. Oh. But a dead person exists. Really? I won the argument, but it was a hollow victory. The logical superiority of a functional ontology over a material one, even in the Sunday comics. I'm trying to show that there really are different ontologies. There are different ways of thinking about existence. And we can't afford to just be locked into ours because we've gotten used to it and we like it and it's worked so long for us. I feel that I can demonstrate that in the ancient world and in the biblical world, in the Israelites themselves, they had a functional ontology. They believed that existence was functional in nature. Therefore, I propose that the Genesis account, reflecting their highest values, is an account of functional origins rather than an account of material origins. If they thought functionally, if that was the core of their ideas of creation and existence, then that is a literal reading of the text. Because that's what they thought. We can't impose our own thoughts on them. So, functions in creation. I've already talked about the first one. Day one, God created time. Day two, God sets up the structures for what Israel understood as producing weather. So God puts a solid sky there, holds back the waters. That's how they thought in the ancient world. That doesn't mean that we have to go find a solid sky. And it certainly doesn't give us room to say, oh, it really wasn't a solid sky because there isn't one, so it must have been something else, and I'll say it's the stratosphere. No, I'm sorry, that word didn't mean stratosphere. We're not reading the text literally. We have to read the text as it was given to them. And so we can say, okay, the material part's not important here. God's not trying to confirm that there's a solid sky. That's not the authority of the text. God's rather saying that whatever happens in the sphere of weather, he's the one who does it. He controls that. He controls time, and he set that function up. He controls weather. He set that function up. I love this picture because it looks like there's eyes there. This is over the Atlantic Ocean. It was a great shot. Okay. Then he creates food. Now, that's what's really happening when we have the dry land emerging from the water. And then he talks about how the fact that he caused plants to sprout. You notice, again, he's not bringing anything material into existence here. The dry land emerged. The plants sprout out of the ground. This is not trying to get material existence going here. It's rather saying this is how things work. This is really cool. Now, don't lose this one. This is really cool. A plant grows. It drops a seed. And the same kind of plant grows. And it drops its seed. And the same kind of plant grows. Let's watch again. Drops its seed. Same kind of plant grows. We've lost the fascination with it. But it's kind of a cool system. And God makes it work. And if it didn't, we'd have big problems. But it works that way, and it provides food for us. A functioning system is what God sets up. Time, weather, food. Those are the three things that frame our existence. If God were talking about cosmic geography, it wouldn't communicate with a whole lot of people in different time periods, in different situations and cultures. If God's talking about time, weather, and food, it talks to everybody everywhere all the time. That's a conversation you have at the supermarket or the bus stop, not about molecules or quarks or cosmic geography. And I say, hey, tell me, what do you think about the Earth moving around the sun today? No, it's time, weather, food. God set up our world to work for us. And that's about one of the most important things we can say about creation. Their values. And there really are values, too. I mean, when you think about it, we spend a lot of time exploring the material cosmos, but our values are found in those functions. So I propose that days 1, 2, and 3 had to do with establishing the three major functions of this world in which we live. Days 4, 5, and 6 have to do with installing functionaries. That is, functionaries are going to be installed to carry out these functions. By the way, in case you're one of those people that worries about the idea that there was light on day 1 and sun, moon, and stars not until day 4, this kind of resolves the situation. We're not talking about a material sequence here. The function of light is far more important, and time is far more important than the functionaries who happen to be involved in it. So the functions are in days 1, 2, and 3, the functionaries in days 4, 5, and 6. Now, as internal evidence to that, all you have to do is go to that passage after the flood. Look at what we've got here. Isn't this intriguing? God says, now that the flood's over, all of the creation is going to restart. It's going to carry out those same functions. Look at what we've got. Okay, seed time and harvest. Oh, that's food. Cold and heat, summer and winter. That's weather. Day and night. That's time. Will never cease. Oh, pushed the wrong button again. Seventh day. You folks are really interested in the seventh day. That's why you should be. You know, the typical view of 6 days of creation totally ignores the seventh day. People talk about the 6 days of creation as if the seventh day is kind of a footnote, an appendix, a theological tag on. And I know that most of you don't believe that, and I don't either. And the view I'm presenting can help demonstrate why that is not the case. Because the seventh day, the most important part of creation happens. And all that took place in the 6 days means nothing if there was no seventh day. Anybody in the ancient world reading Genesis, the 7 days, they would look at that and they would read the part where God rested, and they would say, oh, this is a temple text. And we would say, huh? I don't even see the word temple there. What's going on? What makes you say that? Well, look at it. God rested. And you say, excuse me, I'm just not getting it. God rests in temples. Everybody in the ancient world knows that. God's rest is in a temple. And temples are built for God to rest in. And rest and temple go together. And you can't separate them. What are you, an American? It is not intuitive or transparent to us. This is a great example of why we need the ancient Near Eastern literature, because it can make this plain to us. We have dozens of temple building texts and temple dedication texts, and they make this connection very clear. In the cosmology texts, they make this connection very clear. You often have cosmology texts connected to temple building texts. Temple and cosmos are closely related. So it's no surprise that after a cosmology text, Origins, that now we have God resting. But where's his temple? Well, see, here's where Israel has a slightly different read on it. The ancient Near East, they have lots of different gods, and every god had their own temples, and the main god has his temple, and the other gods like to come and visit his temple, and they have a great time together. But in Israel, we just have one God, and the text tells us in various places in the Old Testament that this temple is connected to the cosmos. When the temple, Solomon's temple, was built, there's a lot of cosmic symbolism, and I can't go through all of that detail, but again, that's all out there in the literature. But the idea that the cosmos is viewed as God's temple, and that the temple is somehow reminiscent or connected to God's cosmos, the temple was seen as the control room of the cosmos. When God took up his rest, his residence in the temple, it's not to relax, it's to rule. It is to rule. Psalm 132, verses 13 and 14. I've chosen Zion. I've taken up my rest there. And I will rule. God's rest is not disengaging. It's engaging. Everything has been ordered. Remember when God tells Israel that he's going to give them rest from their neighbors, their enemies all around. God wasn't saying that I'm going to let you, you know, have 40 winks or, you know, kick back the chair and watch a football game. It wasn't relaxation. It was rather, I'm going to take care of all of this distraction that you have that makes your life miserable and chaotic. And I'm going to give you that rest which allows you to live your life without that kind of interruption and interference. When God gives rest to his people, he brings order to their world. God, through his origins work, bringing functions, has brought order to the world, and now it's ready to run. I suspect that if I asked for a raise of hands, how many of you like moving? I wouldn't get a lot of raising of hands. Why? Because it creates such disarray and chaos. Boxes and boxes and all of this. And you move into a new place, whether it's an apartment or a house, and look at all this mess. And it occupies you for days and weeks. And 5 years later, we still haven't unpacked all the boxes and, you know, all of that. But what are we trying to do? We're trying to bring order to our new world. And we look forward to that day when we unpack the last box and we say, all of that's over. Now I can live my life. I can get back to routines. In the origins accounts, that's what's going on. God is bringing order so that now he is ready to rule this ordered world that he has set up. And so when he takes up his rest in the temple, it is so he can rule. It is the control room. It's the helm. It's the Oval Office. It's the cockpit. Use whatever metaphor you want. But that's what the temple is. And when God rests in it, he's ruling. And that's his role. And that's what he set it up for. So rest and temple are very much connected. And we have people run for the White House so that they can get into the White House. It's not so they can sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. It's so they can sit at the Oval Office, sit at the desk, run the country. This is about God's rule. Now, that's the function of temples in the ancient world. It's the control room of the cosmos. The temple inaugurations in the ancient world was what made those temples functional. You know, Solomon, when he built his temple, he gathered 7 years all the stone and the gold and the materials, and he fixed them all up and got it all ready. And that whole material process gets finished. And there it stands, and you can look at it. Is it a temple? Absolutely not. It's not a temple. Why not? It's there. It exists. No. It's been prepared to be a temple. But it is not a temple because God is not in it. And so they had a temple inauguration process. And in that temple inauguration process, they proclaimed the functions of the temple. They installed the functionaries, whether it's the furniture or the priests. And God entered it and took up his rest. Then it's a temple. It is not uncommon in the literature, biblical and otherwise, to find those inauguration ceremonies connected to 7 days. Seven literal 24-hour days where the functions are proclaimed. The material preparation's already been done. That wasn't 7 days. The functions are proclaimed. The functionaries are installed. And the result of that 7 days, God has now entered his temple. And it's a functioning, existing temple. I'm proposing that Genesis 1 is that same kind of account. It's the inauguration of the cosmic temple. And the 7 days are the 7 days of inauguration. They're not 7 days of material origins. The material preparation had to precede it. There's 7 days of temple inauguration. So that now that all this, whatever period of time of material preparation can result in an existing, a created cosmic temple with God in it and people in God's image in it. And in that sense, Genesis 1 is an account of functional origins of the cosmic temple. Not of the cosmos, scientifically speaking. The cosmic temple. Because that's what God designed this world to be. If that's true, then those 7 days tell us nothing about the age of the earth, because they concern the functional rather than the material. We can take that word day very literally as a 7 24-hour period. And that doesn't affect the age of the earth, because that's material. This is functional. If that's how the Israelites intended it, if that's how they heard it, if that's what Moses meant or whoever did Genesis, if that's how the Israelite audience heard it, then that is the most literal reading we can have. Because that's what they meant. I see my time is not only slipping, it slipped. The text asserts that in the 7-day initial period, that's the beginning, in the beginning, this beginning period where these functions were brought online, God brought the cosmos into operation by assigning roles and functions. He brought it into existence. That's how they thought about existence, functions. That's what creation meant to them, functions. And that's what God did. We like to think of the world in dichotomies. You're one or the other. You're in or out. How about we meet in the middle? Would if I could, but I don't think it's there. Is there a middle? Maybe there is. Maybe we just haven't learned how to think about it. I better stop. We'll have to have some questions. Thank you very much.
Question. If we make a Seventh-day Adventist out of you, will they still let you teach at Wheaton? No. Just kidding. Just a joke. Just a joke. Question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Walton. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Hold it close. All right. Very illuminating in your book, which I've read, also very clear. And I'm finding it compelling and meeting a major need as far as changing several ways. One is that this issue of function has been neglected. So whether function is all of it, as you're saying, or not, it's something that we miss, that it's this important. And you've convinced me that function is very important. So that's a tremendous contribution. The idea of the cosmic temple is also very important theologically, and as you pointed out, is a wonderful theological contribution, a gift to Christians in general, but especially Seventh-day Adventists. The area in which I'd like to... as part of the account in Genesis 1. And that's where I'm having a challenge. What you affirm, I'm finding to be very solid. What you're denying, I'm finding to be a little more problematic for several reasons. One is the use of the terminology, the verbs, in Genesis 1 and 2. It's true that bara refers to function as well as material. Can we cut the fat by eliminating perhaps the word material and say that bara is about phenomena and yetzar is a to form or whatever, it's a sort of a synonym of bara in Genesis 2, it first appears, is talking about phenomena. So light is a phenomenon that's visible, suffering is a phenomenon, and these other kinds of things are phenomena, or even ideas, they're things that happen, and they're coming into existence, so we don't have to argue about material. If material is involved, so be it. And in some of these cases, material has to be involved. But, for example, in Numbers 30, Moses says to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and all of Israel, if God creates, bara, a new thing, and the earth swallows its mouth, now he's not creating new material, but it's a new phenomenon that's happening there. So you're right about that. When it comes to some other verbs, they seem to really refer to something new coming into existence. Yehi, the verb haya, to be. God calls it to be, let there be. Okay, it wasn't before, it is now. It's a phenomenon that wasn't, and it is. Another verb that's important is asa. And you discuss it briefly in your book. Perhaps a little more could be done with that. When God says, let us asa man in our image, it's not let us do man in our image, it's let us make. It doesn't make sense to say let us do. I was just chatting with our friend Dick about that. He pointed that out to me. Another just brief couple of things. In Genesis, there is so a concept we have to take this into account, and obviously you talk about this as an archetype, but it is part of a story of how things happen. So something happened. Perhaps the most important thing though to mention is what is the genre of Genesis 1? Now you say it's the temple inauguration, the publishing inauguration. That idea, that's convincing. I mean, that concept is there, but it seems to me that the explicit genre, if we were to label this story by Hebrew terminology itself, it comes in 2 verse 4, Ele Toledot. It's a Toledot story. And Toledot, from the root Yelad, begetting something. Next time we get to this verb is in Genesis 5 verse 1. These are the Toledot of Adam. Just like these are the Toledot of heaven and earth. And so this means that we have a structured community of functional things that are brought into existence. And the unique thing in Genesis 1 is it's a community of functional phenomena. But they do come into existence at this point, and they become a functional family, all in a process that apparently is 6 days, or 7 days, rather, of Genesis 1 to 2, verse 4. Okay, I've thrown a lot at you, but I'm... in other words, I'm seeing, but I'm not seeing the denial of material. I don't think the Israelites would have made a dichotomy between material and function the way you're doing.
While you're thinking about that, some of us, our Hebrew is a little rusty. I wonder if we could try not to be quite so technical with the Hebrew, but let's have you respond.
Well, my main response is if you want to sign up for my course, it takes me a whole semester to deal with even half of those things. And, of course, we could have a lot of discussion with these, as we've already had some. But let me address specifically the issue of why, I'm in an act here, why can't it be both material and functional? After all, do we have to, you know, just go one way or the other? Is it a toggle? And of course, it wouldn't have to be. But I've given you at least some of the evidence of why I see the functional aspect. Material is not a default that's there automatically, just because that's the way we most easily think. You would have to demonstrate that the material, so that would be the case that you'd have to make. I think there are some drawbacks to material and the material focus, especially if we bring that into the authority. Because the, if he's really saying the solid sky with waters above, then we'd have to find that to authenticate it. If this were some material affirmation of how things really are, we would have to go find those. That somehow changing what those Hebrew words would have meant. And so I think there's a real drawback to trying take them materially. And again, and it's not that it couldn't be, but it's just a Sarah.
My first question is dealing with something that comes in Proposition 10. You mentioned that people have been granted the image of God. And then in your little facts section, you mentioned that the anthropological specimens that would have come before what happens during the 7 days would not be considered humans in the image of God. I'm just wondering how long is the material stage? Because if you're looking at the question that you are answering here in your fact section is where have the dinosaurs and fossil Homo specimens fit in? And you have that as part of the pre-functional cosmos. So I'm just curious about that. And the other thing that I'm curious about is, I think it's also in Proposition 10, yeah, it is, on death and how death was there during creation and after creation and before the fall. How does that fit in with sin? Because you have the antidote for Adam and Eve. So that they didn't die and that they're more human beings being the tree of life. So does that mean that they were the only creative beings that were?
As I understand it, Paul's concerns about death don't involve death as a whole throughout the system. They involve death for people. That is, Paul's asking the question, why is it that people die? And it's because of sin. And that's the answer he gives. He's not talking about death in the system as a whole, that in my understanding of it. And, of course, the reason why people die is because of sin. I believe, and again, I tried to defend this in the book, that people were created with mortal bodies, but that they were given an antidote to their mortality with the tree of life. Otherwise, why do you need a tree of life? And when God condemns them to death, he prevents them getting access to the tree of life. And so he made us from dust, as it says, and to dust we shall return, because there's no antidote to prevent that. So human death comes by sin, exactly as Paul said, no problems. Death at other levels still existed in the system, always existed in the system, and was set up to be that way. Now again, I think I can give some evidence of that, although it's it reaches into our understanding of science, but I know, for instance, from the text that Adam and Eve had skin, because Adam says, you are flesh of my flesh, so I know they had skin, and we know what skin is. It's dead cells, epidermis, okay? That means that if Adam had skin, he had dead cells, and there was death in the system. You say, oh, but that's cells. Well, where are you going to draw the line? Okay, if you allow death at any level, then you have to draw the line somewhere. Some people would say, draw it at sentient beings. But that's arbitrary, okay? And Paul doesn't make any specification of that. You draw the line, I would say, with where I think Paul intends with people.
My question is, if the material did not have function before the creation account,
how would things be able to evolve before that time? Because without function, natural selection can't work.
Okay, when I say that things were lacking function, I'm not talking about scientific function. Okay, it's not like the sun didn't shine. It's not like there was nothing that we would call time. Okay, rather, the function is relative to people in God's image. Okay, remember when it talks about the functions, for instance, of the sun. It doesn't talk about their functions as a burning ball of gas or reflective piece of rock. For the moon, it talks about it for signs, seasons, days, and years, functioning for people. So it's not an abstract concept of scientifically functioning by material properties that the text is interested in. The idea that God set it up for us. So it's the same kind of question that if a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody to hear it, does it still make a sound? Okay? Well, you need a receptor. And for these functions, the way the text is talking about them, you need it's being set up for people in God's image. And so that's the kind of functions that I'm talking about.
I have two questions. My first question is, do you believe in creation ex nihilo? Because if you believe that God merely reordered or ordered
the waters as you described at the beginning during creation week, where do you believe that God created that matter? And secondly, if you believe that there was death in animal life forms, or I'm not exactly clear on that point, but if you believe that there was death before creation weekend, death and chaos, then how can you wrap your head around it says in heaven that there will be no more death, and they will not kill nor destroy in all my holy mountain. That's in the Bible. So how can you believe that if you believe that God created things that would die and there was sin and death and destruction before Adam and Eve sinned?
Oh, I didn't say sin. Okay. Good questions. Let me answer them. Creation ex nihilo. Okay, remember, I'm not saying that God did not create the material world. I'm only saying that Genesis 1 is not giving us that part of the story. Anything that is here materially, God created it. And when he created it out of nothing, because the only other alternative is for it to exist independently, autonomously from God, and I don't believe that. That wouldn't be biblical theology. So whenever God did the material work, he did it out of nothing. Okay, but I don't think that Genesis 1 has that part of the story. I believe it has the functional part of the story. Now, in terms of death before the fall, again, I did not say sin before the fall. But I would say that if it were true that there was a long period of material existence before this functional origins in Genesis 1, then yes, there would have been death in that system, including animal death. Now, I don't find that to be a contradiction to Revelation, because I don't see any reason that Revelation has to be reflecting a return to Genesis 1. Some people think that it is, and they interpret it that way, but I don't see anything in the text that demands that we see Revelation as a return to the pre-fall state. And if that's not the case, then you can't use Revelation to say what it would have been like prior to the fall.
I'm sorry that this kicks in and out. Be patient.
Mine's kicking in and out too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
My question is similar to hers, but in the Genesis 1 text itself, it seems like it's very clearly saying that God gave the animals only vegetarian diet, and that he saw that everything was good, and I just can't see how there could be any predation with the description that we have in Genesis 1.
Again, in Genesis 1, we're dealing with the functions for this human world. If God is limiting that diet to plants, then that's connected to this functional system that he set up in Genesis 1. That doesn't necessarily reflect what situation might have existed for who knows how long leading up to that. Okay, that's the Genesis 1. And that's how those functions were set up when the functional system was put in place. Again, that certainly doesn't solve all the issues, but I would see that distinction. I need to let you know, too, I don't do this to try to push some scientific theory. I'm not a scientist, and I've got no vested interest in sciences. Apologies to the scientists here. I know you do, but I don't. And so I'm not doing this so I can get away with some kind of scientific view, whether it concerns the age of the Earth, or whether it concerns evolution, or whether it concerns fossil record, or whether it concerns anthropology. I don't know enough about that to let that drive anything. Okay? I'm trying to understand the text as best I can. Because the way I approach it, and I know scientists can't always afford to do this, but the way I approach it is that I want to know what the Bible is going to ask me to stand up and go to the wall for. And if the Bible's asking me to do that, boy, I'm ready. I'm going to go to the wall and I'll die on that hill if I need to. But I certainly don't want to adopt that position for something I don't need to. And if in reconsidering the biblical text, I say, wait a minute, I don't have to die on that age of the earth hill. I don't have to go to the wall for this or that or the other thing. If the Bible doesn't require me to do that, well, now I can say, okay, science, tell me what you've got. I may like it, I may not, I may reject it, I may not, it might be right, it might be wrong. But go ahead, it's your turn. Okay, because I've tried to get a clear view of where the Bible asks me to stand. And, if need be, where it asks me to die.
Thank you for your book. It's a great book to learn from, and it's a great book to dialogue with, or possibly even fight with. It's a great book. In the ancient Near East temple inauguration idea, you have similarities, and you point them out. As you point them out, they seem obvious, and this being a temple inauguration, based on that, is an excellent addition to the conversation, and thank you very much for that. But I wonder what you do with the differences between what we find in Genesis 1 and 2 and the ancient Near Eastern temple inaugurations. For instance, a massive difference is that the temple inaugurations in the ancient Near Eastern texts are built by humans that were created to keep the gods from having to do physical labor, and they are to bring the god down to them or give the god a place to rest, whatever you're going to talk about there. But this temple inauguration is in a temple that is built by God. A massive difference. And whereas temples take a long time to build, but a short time to inaugurate, we're talking about God here.
Certainly God can do it any way that he wants. Okay, again, I'm not trying to say that the material process had to be a long one. Maybe it is a young earth after all, and God did that material stuff like this as August. Was it Augustine? Thought it was in
Plato says it.
All at once, yeah.
Whoever.
Augustine, Plato. Okay.
What's the difference?
Yeah.
You know, God can do it however he wants. Okay, but my point is that if this is a functional account, then I can listen to whatever theories I want to about material origins, long or short, and it wouldn't make that difference. Now, in terms of the ancient Near Eastern material, of course, there are always similarities and differences, and we need to take those seriously. Okay, that's part of comparative studies. You can't do just one side of that equation. And yes, Israelite theology was considerably different, and God is the one who has constructed this cosmic temple, and that's not the same thing at all. When in the Babylonian creation account, you have Marduk's cosmology, where he sets up the cosmos, and then they build a temple in Babylon for him. Okay, and that's because the idea of the cosmos as a temple doesn't work so well in Babylonian thinking. Okay, so there are massive, significant differences. But, again, those are things that we can account for along the way. That doesn't detract from the idea that we do have a cosmic inauguration, cosmic temple inauguration. It doesn't take away from that possibility.
I'd like to shift just a little bit from the tone of what we've had so far back to the selection of comparative texts. And I'm a novice, I don't know anything about this, but from what I've heard, I'm just trying to reconcile these things. My understanding is that probably Moses got these things from some library or something in Egypt that he copied into the Bible, potentially. It's two stories that he starts off with. And my concept and my guess is that what the thought processes were, and maybe the culture was before the flood, is something we know perhaps very little about. Now, do we have much literature from back there to really compare these two? I'm just trying to ask, you know, what do we really have that's comparable that is not recent or more recent Near Eastern culture and philosophy and thought processes? How valid is your comparison is what I'm really getting to.
You know, I tend to use whatever ancient Near Eastern literature I can get my hands on. And to try, because I'm not trying to find a document comparison. I'm trying to find a worldview window. Okay, so that's how I'm driven with that. I don't know that Moses had to get his material from ancient Near Eastern sources, and I'm not suggesting anything like that, that somehow Moses accessed cosmologies of the ancient world. I think living in Egypt and Moses being educated in Egypt, he couldn't have missed having been exposed to some of the Egyptian ones at least. But again, you know, you read the Egyptian ones and they're very different from Genesis. It's not even close enough that you could call it polemic, because if it were polemic, you'd have to touch base a little more often with what it was that the Egyptians were saying. So it's not that kind of thing where I'm talking about document comparison. Moses' worldview would have reflected the worldview around him. He grew up in that. All the Israelites did. They grew up in that world. And therefore, they thought in lots of the same ways that world thought. It's the same way with you. Your cognitive environment reflects having been raised in this time, in this country, or wherever it was you were raised, if you weren't raised in this country. And your cognitive environment is impacted by that. You're not borrowing anything. You just are who you are. You have to think some ways, and you learn how to think in your culture. Okay? You didn't borrow consumerism from anyone. Okay? You have it. And if, even if you try not to have it, you can't avoid it. You didn't borrow your individualism. You didn't borrow your values of liberty and freedom and rights. This is how you grew up. And likewise, the Israelites grew up as a people and as individuals in a world that thought in certain ways. And they didn't have to think about adopting them or not. They just have these ways of thinking. And that's how they're going to work through whatever it is they work through. And so in that sense, they don't have to read anybody's literature. And this isn't a matter of one piece of literature being borrowed from another. It's simply, again, what I call it, the cognitive environment. It's the world they grew up in. And that's what we would expect them to reflect.
Hello again.
Hi.
Am I on? All right. I think one of the things I want to take away this evening is there are things in Scripture to go to the wall for and fight for and, if necessary, die for. That was a remarkably eloquent statement of your commitment and your faith. Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't know which question to ask. Light seems to me to be something. In Job, the light lives somewhere. And the word for Tohu is where, in Job again, he hangs the north. And then in terms of the cosmology that you showed us, and it's in the same book I mentioned last night, you would know that, Old Testament theology today. But I'm wondering if we have some kind of confusion between the metaphor and the literal. In Job, once again, he hangs the earth on nothing. That's a straightforward, literal statement, evoking the ancient Near Eastern imagery and having it occur and pervade the text is completely legitimate. But how do we explain away he hangs the earth on nothing? The question that most drives me, though, is what about Jesus and Satan? Does Jesus actually believe this stuff? Is this what he believed as a man when he was here? And what about Satan? Isn't it making it so much easier for Satan when we allow that the chaos was always there and it is part of God's order and he does these things by killing animals or having them die hundreds and millions of years and hundreds of millions of years of suffering, aren't we making it easier for Satan when we attribute all of this to God, or at least allow? Well, you know, I don't have a stand on that, but it may be Jesus' way of doing things. That's the one that really... Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. I know that these are issues that we all think about and consider very deeply. You know, on the specifics of Job, it's great to talk about God hanging the world on nothing, but the Hebrew word we have there, and I don't want to bounce Hebrew on you, but it's belimod, it doesn't occur anywhere else. And there's a significant question whether it means nothing.
But it's part of the tohu in Genesis.
Yeah.
So that's a problem.
Who's the other side of it? And again, I'm currently writing a commentary on Job, and I've offered my understanding of that, but it is very technical and wouldn't be productive to get into it here. But in terms of something that might be more on the minds of everyone here, your second point, we are not in a position, like Job, we are not in a position to call God to account. And he sometimes chooses to do things in ways that don't make sense to us. I am not saying that God authorized chaos to reign. Remember, I backed off from using the word chaos. Disorder is not the same thing as chaos. Okay? The idea that it was not yet fully ready to function for people in God's image is not saying it's chaos. Okay? And so, in that sense, I would not admit to chaos as reigning through that process. Now, we don't like the idea that animals would have suffered death, and that somehow that could have been part of God's way of working. But likewise, we don't understand why God took so long to reveal Jesus as the means for salvation. And so many people died without that knowledge in history past. And so many people today die without that knowledge. And why would God allow such suffering and disappointment with just a communication? He could do that. He didn't. And we cannot call God to account. We might be confused. We might be concerned. And to some extent, our concern does us credit, because we want justice and we want things to be the way they ought to be. But we cannot call God to the bar and ask him to account for himself.
Okay, I think this be our last question.
Thank you. I don't know if this mic is on. I got home from the seminary faculty. I can see all the things that I've been careful with.
Why didn't he have Jesus born to Adam and Eve? Take care of things right away. Well,
why didn't he have the Bible automatically dropped into everyone's lap in their own language so they could all know about Jesus? Well, again, we don't know why he would choose to do it one way or the other. And again, we are in no position to call him to account on that. In terms of where I stand, scientifically, okay, again, I am not promoting a science or a scientific conclusion. I am, being not a scientist, I am not really in a position very well to evaluate the merits of a scientific case. If you ask the question whether I think that evolution is problematic for people who take the Bible seriously, in general, I would say no. If Genesis 1 is not a material account, or not an account of material origins, then we don't have a biblical account of material origins, and then we are free to listen to somebody else's suggestions on accounts for material origins. Now, I don't know if evolution provides that well or not. Well, we can hear what other people have to say, but no matter what idea of material origins we are presented with, make no mistake, God did it. And God was involved in the process. Now, last night I dealt with the idea that just because we could explain something materially doesn't mean God's out of that picture. And if the scientists offer an account of material origins that involves some aspect of evolutionary thinking, just because we have evolutionary thinking doesn't mean God didn't do it or God wasn't involved. Again, whatever happened, God did it. So I'm not here to push a scientific conclusion. I don't have one to offer. I'm only trying to deal with what is it that the Bible tells me I can't accept as a possibility. And if the Bible doesn't offer a material account, then we don't have a biblical account of material origins. But we do know for certain. Of course, again, you're right. We can't question God. I wondered why didn't he have Jesus born to Adam and Eve? Take care of things right away. Why didn't he have the Bible automatically dropped into everyone's lap in their own language so they could all know about Jesus? Well, again, we don't know why he would choose to do it one way or the other. And again, we are in no position to call him to account on that. In terms of where I stand, scientifically, okay, again, I am not promoting a science or a scientific conclusion. I am, being not a scientist, I am not really in a position very well to evaluate the merits of a scientific case. If you ask the question whether I think that evolution is problematic for people who take the Bible seriously, in general, I would say no. If Genesis 1 is not a material account, or not an account of material origins, then we don't have a biblical account of material origins, and then we are free to listen to somebody else's suggestions of accounts for material origins. Now, I don't know if evolution provides that well or not, but we can hear what other people have to say. But no matter what idea of material origins we are presented with, make no mistake, God did it. And God was involved in the process. Now, last night I dealt with the idea that just because we could explain something materially doesn't mean God's out of that picture. And if the scientists offer an account of material origins that involves some aspect of evolutionary thinking, just because we have evolutionary thinking doesn't mean God didn't do it or God wasn't involved. Again, whatever happened, God did it. So I'm not here to push a scientific conclusion. I don't have one to offer. I'm only trying to deal with what is it that the Bible tells me I can't accept as a possibility. And if the Bible doesn't offer a material account, then we don't have a biblical account of material origins. But we do know for certain that whatever happened, God did it. He could have done it like that. He could have done it over billions of years. Neither one are lacking the glory and the majesty of God. And so that's not a concern. Nothing that would be possibly acceptable would leave God off to the side or out of the picture.
Sorry, we couldn't get to all questions. It's a big topic. We'll probably have another program on it sometime in the future. But our brother in Christ from Wheaton College, we thank you very much for coming. Thank you.